Welcome, listeners, to your late October edition of RSP Discourse. I'm Chris Cotter, and I am joined today. Who am I joined by? I'm joined by Theo. Who are you, Theo?
I'm Theo Wildcroft. I'm just finishing my PhD with the Open University here in the UK.
Okay, and we're joined from across the big pond by Chris Silver.
Yep. Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Chris Silver, and I am I'm in the Learning and Leadership program at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and I'm completing a second doctorate in social psychology.
Because you
have
imposter syndrome much?
A little, yes. Yeah, just a little.
So first off, listeners, apologies. This is quite... we're having some minor audio issues, so my hopes are that this is going to work out smoothly. It's also a little bit later than we would have liked to have recorded, but that's because someone was at a big conference. You're at the SSSR, Chris. How was that?
It was good, yeah. SSSR is the Society for the Scientific Study of Religion. It's a pretty big multidisciplinary conference. And it was in Las Vegas this year, and so it was fascinating. A number of people who study religion being in Sin City. So,
you were saying you were enjoying doing a bit of people watching while you were there.
Yeah, it's almost worth just going and doing a study in Vegas of all the different kinds of people intersecting on gambling. So,
yeah. And what you said you were involved with, like, three or four different panels and grant applications and all sorts of things. What was your SSSR like?
It was pretty good. Very busy. It's probably one of the busiest SSSRs I've had. I was I presented three papers and was co-authored on two more. So ranging from concealment in atheists and agnostics to looking at social tension as a predictor of prejudice, which is interesting. And then also continue to work with my colleagues at the University of Bielefeld, doing a qualitative and quantitative study of people's changes in their beliefs and faith. So,
and Theo, you've got a Viva coming up very soon, don't you?
Way too soon. Yeah. Yes. So I'm in I've been in that gap between submitting and wondering, scratching my head, and my Viva's actually next Wednesday. So I'm just starting the run-up to panic. But my primary supervisor, Graham Harvey, has limited me to only 24 hours of stressing about it. I'm not really sure when that 24 hours is allowed, whether I'm allowed to spread that out over the next week or just the day before, but he says I'm only allowed to stress about my Viva for 24 hours.
Okay.
That's the official.
Well, you know, he's just trying to exert his last bit of supervisorial authority there. Less than 30 seconds, what was the thesis about?
I can do that now. I'm looking at changing authority relationships and perceptions of authority in contemporary yoga cultures, particularly here in the UK. So I started out looking at a fairly understudied, little known subculture, but the implications of the structures, the kind of the cultural structures that I found have much wider implications than that. So I'm already being hassled for the book. At the moment.
We're sending you all the best. No one knows your research better than you, so it will be fine. It will be fine. So the idea of these discourse episodes is that they go out to our sort of paying patrons and also some select others. So the BASR membership, as a BASR are our sponsors, so we give the patrons access to those, and some departments have sort of given us sort of corporate sponsorship. So we pass these on to their students as well. And the idea is that we take the sort of RSP sort of critical religious studies lens and turn it towards some contemporary media stories involving the contested word religion or developments in the field and so on. we're recording this on the 30th of October, and we're well aware that there've been another couple of incidents in the US that we certainly can't really not talk about. As a resident stateside correspondent, Chris, you might be best suited to situate those for us.
Yeah, I mean, of course, post-election of Trump, there's been quite a bit of discourse in the media related to issues of identity, diversity, and also like what should be the appropriate response of, you know, a president in times of sort of intergroup conflict. And, and of course, we've seen in the past month of gentleman out of Miami who's of course sending pipe bombs to sort of key liberal figures. We've seen of course just a day or so ago we had a mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then just as of a couple of hours ago there was a number of Methodist minister protesters who appeared at a speech given by Jeff Sessions. And of course, these ministers are United Methodists, which also Jeff Sessions himself calls himself a United Methodist. And so, and these ministers, of course, telling Mr. Sessions that he needs to repent and needs to be helping the sort of poor and you know, and the disenfranchised. And so, you know, it's interesting. It's just that, you know, it's odd that we have all these things around, particularly even religion specifically, going on right now in the U.S. and a lot of sort of the tension, conflict, perceived threat that comes with these identities and sort of a post-Trump presidency. So,
and yeah, it was quite interesting. I saw a tweet earlier in the day that Russ McCutcheon retweeted, just saying that apparently Israel's chief rabbi has refused to refer to the site of the Pittsburgh terror attack as a synagogue, because apparently the rabbinate in Israel doesn't recognize conservative or reformed Judaism as proper Judaism, and instead he called it, quote, a place with a clear Jewish characteristic.
yeah, it is.
Interesting to see classification matters happening at times when you would, you would think that people would be thinking about more important things.
Well, yeah, being more sensitive.
I think on the other hand, I think that's a really interesting double story in terms of American politics around Islam as well going on here, in that one of the reasons stated for the Pittsburgh synagogue being targeted was that it donated to HIAS, which is a Jewish aid society for refugees, which amongst other things helps obviously refugees who happen to be Muslim. And I believe that in response to the attacks, specifically Islamic faith organizations have raised huge sums of money to aid the survivors as well. So you've got this really interesting issues, not just around identity, but around kind of membership of groups. Like so it's all about solidarity in the end, isn't it? Who's allowed to associate with who? Who's in the group and who isn't in the group? It makes one long for that kind of quite sweet interfaith attitude, which says, you know, it's all about just all coming together and being nice, and if we just all get in a room together, it'll be fine. And now, the fact that faith groups help other faith groups is seen as justification for that act of white terrorism, basically. And I think that's really interesting. It's worth also remembering that this isn't the other thing that's happened is the two people shot outside a majority black church in Kentucky as well. And there's been a certain amount, talking about identity politics, there's been a certain amount of question as to whether the lack of media attention on that is somehow racially coded, or whether it's just down to the sheer fatigue. I know that from somebody speaking from the other side of the ocean, it's getting difficult to remember which attack is which in America, I have to say.
No, I think you're right. Actually, Theo, you brought up another good point about the sort of the post solidarity that we've seen in some of these sort of tragic events. And I would also add to that, which I'm glad you brought this up, is that after the synagogue shooting, there's now been a call for a number of candlelight vigils that are a number of cities all around the United States, including here in the South. In fact, here in Chattanooga, which is very much in the center of sort of the Bible Belt, they've planned an interfaith candlelight vigil here downtown. And so, and while these events are incredibly unfortunate, I think they also show the good humanity as well, you know, that people want to try to come together and, you know, recognize that you know, these are just horrific events, you know, and so I'm with you. I think there is something sort of, you know, sort of redeems my view of humanity when, you know, people come together with these kinds of things.
We're already 12 minutes in and we're dwelling on sort of quite depressing news. I know this will also be a depressing link, but it's a link towards a perhaps more fun topic for us. Apparently in Northern Ireland, my native land, on Sunday night, there was an incident in Newtownards, in County Down, so just south of Belfast, where a group gathered outside an Islamic centre, dressed in KKK outfits. And apparently this is being, it was portrayed as though it was a sort of strange Halloween type stunt sort of thing that people didn't quite realize exactly what they were doing. But obviously it's being treated incredibly seriously,
can I clarify? Because I'm not aware of the details of the story. The people involved in dressing up, are they claiming this was a Halloween stunt?
And it certainly, the director of the Belfast Islamic Centre said, to quote him, he said, "I understand it's Halloween, people are dressed in costume, but to go there specifically wearing that costume in front of the Islamic Centre is not acceptable." So I don't know if it was something that had been, maybe there was a reason that this community representative felt the need to say that. I don't know that they know who the individuals are. It's not the first time the centre's been targeted. I mean, this is a fairly common thing in a UK context, but not so much in a Northern Irish context, which is associated with other kinds of bigotry and whatnot. So,
yeah, it's very, yes. Yes, there's only so much social capacity for sectarian hatred, weirdly, in communities, isn't there? So it's interesting how some things can get pushed to the bottom of the pile because other things are more locally significant, I guess. And interesting as well that if it's KKK costumes, then that's also an imported idea, and that kind of it brings to mind the regular, I think almost yearly, getting into trouble that some celebrity or public figure will always get into trouble every year for having dressed in some sort of Nazi-related uniform. And which, of course, I think rarely happens, or at least rarely happens in that supposedly innocent way in Germany itself, because it's actually a hate crime. You can't actually do it. But it's interesting it fascinates me that people will import symbols of national and racial purity. You would think in itself that would make them somewhat compromised. But no, that's how we demonstrate our nationalism in Belfast, is to wear clothing associated with extremism in America. It's very odd when you actually think about it. How these things work, I guess.
But to move towards perhaps a sort of more lighter note, Theo, you found an article in The Guardian on a sort of Well, I think you described it as a sort of hyper middle class guide to trick or treating or something.
It's really fabulous. Zoe Williams in The Guardian, he can have a tendency towards this, I think, has literally set out a do's and don'ts for how to go trick or treating, which I think is really fascinating. There's something very, very, very middle class about the whole thing. You know, I think it's supposed to be fairly light-hearted, but it also speaks to anxieties about getting it wrong. And I think that's really interesting within a cultural moment that sees trick-or-treating happening more and more across the UK. I think over the last few years we've seen that. And indeed, I think the guide itself is rather adorable. It says there are certain things which I'm aware have somehow become the cultural norm, which one is that you don't knock on a door that doesn't have a lit pumpkin.
Right.
Which I think is really fascinating. So we have, you know, there are certain areas, I think particularly, you know, there are certain areas where you knock on every door, or you only knock on doors of people you know, or so on and so forth. But this idea that you signal your availability to be trick or treated there's something really domesticated about that these traditions are based in something much more anarchic, much more about misbehaving. You know, that's the whole origin of trick or treating and guising and all the other things that it's based on. There was much more about not behaving, and the idea that you can civilize that, you can domesticate it into something that says, well, I'm prepared to be trick or treated. Although, of course, there's never any trick, is there, these days? There is just the chocolate and the dressing up. But it has all sorts of things. You know, don't travel in groups of more than five. It creates a bottleneck. You know, don't take more than one of anything, all of these kinds of things. But what's even more interesting is actually the comments. And as is often the case in The Guardian, there's lots of interesting comments about people saying when and where they feel this tradition comes from. So people saying, no, this is entirely an imported American tradition. Other people pointing out that it's actually a Scottish tradition, which I believe is true. It's a Scottish tradition which went to the States and has now come back again. But other people saying, oh, yes, but it's completely different in Scotland. When you're guising, you have to do something, and it's turnips, not pumpkins. And there's a really, really interesting kind of, there's very definite rules in all of this, but no one can seem to agree on quite what they are. Which really fits, doesn't it, with these kind of fuzzy lines between religion and popular culture, I think.
Exactly. It's become a real site for anxieties as well. You know, so at like schools, I gather now have sort of, well, you can come in fancy dress, but it can't be anything scary. No clowns. It tends to be a thing that, you know, just not allowed in school contexts, you know, because clowns are now so scary.
They are, and quite.
Is that all Stephen King's doing?
Clowns are quite scary, to be fair.
Agreed.
There was even, since I spotted that article, there's even something else that was shared on Facebook this morning by a friend, which I thought was interesting again, which is kind of the pushback to this guide, which says that, you know, that points out that, for example, if the child takes more, if you have a child comes to the door with the following behaviors, they may not be being rude, they may just have additional needs. So if a child takes a handful of candy rather than one, they've probably got fine motor issues. If they take a while to choose, they may have motor planning issues. If they don't say trick or treat, they may have communication issues, and so on and so forth. And it's just fascinating that we've also gone so far in that direction, that it's also about making things as gentle as possible for the children, which is what you were saying about the schools as well. Whereas again, the origin of the tradition is in little monsters being out at night, basically misbehaving. Which is really interesting, I think.
I would also add, here in the Southeast U.S., Halloween's always been an interesting time for a lot of evangelicals. And like, but to also your pumpkin on the front porch, like one of the ways that people communicate in the South that they're open for trick-or-treating is they leave their front porch light on. So that signals to trick-or-treaters that this is a house that is participating. And, you know, if the front porch light is off, then you know to skip that house and go to the next one. And some of the churches have even gone to what they're calling a trunk or treat, where they'll have certain rules about certain costumes that you can wear that, you know, don't necessarily signal demonic, you know, or, you know, some kind of evil influence. And so instead of going, you know, around one's neighborhood, they basically go to their local church and people sit on the back of their cars with their trunk open and the kids walk, come by and pick up pieces of candy and put it back.
Yeah, it's yet more domestication. It's really interesting. Whereas certainly most of my pagan friends are exactly the opposite. There's an absolute joyousness in being able to make things as spooky as possible and to fill other people's children with as much sugar as possible. It's kind of part of the point, right? There's something a little bit wilder and a little bit less civilized about that, about how all these things play out within Halloween. There's a I'm not sure if it's still ongoing, but we live quite close to Avebury Stone Circle here. And there's a very beautiful, or there always was a very beautiful, little known ceremony that happens here at midnight on Halloween. And you have to know about it and you have to know where it is, but it's in part of the Avebury landscape. And it's held in darkness. It's very, very simple. You take, there's a whole bucket of apples there. And one by one, someone will pick an apple up and they will dedicate that apple to somebody who's passed over this year, someone who's died that's close to them. And then they put the apples in the center, and the person running the ritual takes those apples somewhere and disposes of them ritually around dawn. And it is one of the most kind of moving, most beautiful kind of rituals I think I've ever had the privilege to be part of. But it has that moment of strangeness which makes any ritual work, which is that it's held in the sanctuary, and the sanctuary doesn't have the stones or the posts as they were anymore in this Neolithic monument. What it has is all these little concrete posts that stick up about 6 inches from the floor, which lay out where the Neolithic arrangement of posts and things would have been. So it's dark, it's midnight, people are making all these moving statements about their grandmothers or their dogs that have passed or so on and so forth, and then they walk into the center of the circle and put this apple down, and this whole thing is punctuated regularly by kind of people tripping over concrete posts and going ow and dropping the apple and so on and so forth. This kind of moving ritual regularly punctuated by thunk, that's another post, thunk, that's another post. Really strange thing that happens, and just shows quite how powerful really simple things can be, I think, really.
Definitely. And we, yeah, I first off, just three things to throw in here. Of course, yeah, Edinburgh Samhain celebrations are pretty massive, as are Beltane celebrations later in the year. But of course, I was reminded that folks in the Southern Hemisphere will be celebrating potentially Beltane at this time of year rather than Samhain. Yeah. And we often, you know, I always find it fascinating the way in popular culture we end up with spirits and demons and spooks and ghosts and everything coming into popular discourse at this time. Again, in a very sort of constrained period, and perhaps it could be argued in some ways that the festival is sort of serving its a purpose that it might have served in the past, but for, quote, secular society, unquote, you know, allowing a release of remember the spirits and the dead and the ghouls and the ghosts and stuff that used to populate our world and that we've now boxed off into this sort of one day. I'm aware that time is getting on, but I do want us to make sure we get to talk about cakes.
Yes.
Before we go. So quickly on cakes, to contextualize things, so a bakery, again, in my native Northern Ireland, was asked to make a cake And it wasn't a gay marriage cake. It was a cake with a message on it that was pro gay marriage.
Yes.
And the bakery refused because it conflicted with the owner's beliefs, apparently. And then this was taken right up to the sort of highest echelons of the UK court system. And I think the decision was made that they were allowed to discriminate in this instance because it was a cake with a politicized message, but that if it had been an actual cake to celebrate an actual gay wedding, then it would have been discrimination. Is that
Dan? Yes, I believe so. Yes, because it's the European Convention on Human Rights which protects beliefs and political opinions. So it's the freedom not to express an opinion which one does not hold, basically. So they can't be forced to write support gay marriage because they don't support gay marriage, but they cannot refuse to make a cake for a same-sex wedding. So that was really interesting. So because they made the justice at the court said that the bakers did not refuse to fulfill his order because of his sexual orientation. They would have refused to make a cake for any such customer who asked them to make the same message. So therefore, they couldn't say it was discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation. I thought that was really interesting. Mm. But on a meta level, this is at least the second gay wedding cake that I'm aware of, because there was a relatively famous American case a little while ago which went the other way, because I believe it was a cake to commemorate a marriage, to commemorate a wedding rather than with a political statement on it. And I'm fascinated by the emerging use of cakes in kind of LGBT and queer advocacy and human rights. Why patisserie, basically? That's what's amusing me at the moment.
No, I mean, it's certainly interesting. I mean, well, in one sense, my religious studies roots for a second, is the whole symbolism that food plays in religion, as well as proper ceremonies and those types of events. And so, so in one sense, you know, I see the connection. Alternatively, food's also this mundane act that we do every day, right? So, but Theo's point's well taken. It's like, why cakes? You know, I mean, what if someone wanted the punch bowl to have, you know, some kind of LGBTQ+ symbolism on it, you know, with whoever serving the punch refused to, you know, it's those kinds of weird questions of, you know, between the person and context, you know.
My off the cuff conjecture would probably be that, you know, for example, so I've been looking a lot at the humanist societies in the UK at the moment and their provision of life cycle rituals as alternatives to religious life cycle rituals, and so basically it seems to me that it is quite it may be quite easy for people to rub alongside each other with different beliefs quite easily, but it's when those beliefs get enacted in some way that it then becomes problematic, you know. Beliefs that are never performed ultimately don't matter in that sense. So first off, most people's interaction with these sort of religion related institutions tends to be around these major life cycle rituals, particularly weddings, funerals, and I suppose at these junctures culturally in our context, at least, cakes are quite common. And so if you're going to be fighting a battle based on sort of legitimizing alternative or practices, then maybe a cake's one way to do that. Well, it clearly has been picked up as one way to do that.
I think
it's also like the most inoffensive weapon possible.
I think a couple of things there. I think that there's, speaking as someone who has skin in the game, so to speak, that there is something specific about not just marriage, but about weddings in terms of having your relationship not so much sanctioned by your friends and family and loved ones, but celebrated, right? And that is an important right. And certainly in actually two long-term relationships of my own with women, we had commitment ceremonies, even though they weren't legal, because it was important for us to celebrate and have celebrations that that people could come to, and there were definitely cakes at both. So I think there's something about that symbol within the wedding space. Maybe the vows are something that happen between you, but the cake is definitely something that you share, right? You cut it and it goes and it gets shared with other people. So there is something around that right, I think, to have that. The second, I just want to pick up, I know why you use that language, but I think it's important to pick up that we're not talking necessarily about a difference in belief here. We're talking on the one hand about sexual identity and on the other hand about religious belief. And they are two different things. And it's important to remember that one of the ways that I think some religious conservatives push back against the rights of LGBT people is by talking about them as a lifestyle choice, that somehow belief for them is more innate than sexuality. Whereas obviously from my argument and the argument of most people would be the opposite. It would be that certainly sexual identity is not something that you choose or that you are active in that sense that believing often has.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for picking me up on that. but it's also, and we could go on and on and on here. It's interesting also just the idea of a business having a perspective in this sense, like what makes a particular brand of Christian business. So it's got all sorts of implications for secularity.
Yeah, and that bigger question about businesses and identities, isn't there? There's all sorts. I think more so in this, we said that more so in the States than here, that we see all sorts of businesses at all sorts of levels of size declaring the beliefs of their owners or founders as being somehow embedded within the organization as a whole. And we see that in so many different ways. But I'm aware of cases of, large businesses refusing to support the kind of what we would call the family health planning of, in other words, contraception, healthcare, the provision of contraceptive healthcare for their employees and, all sorts of issues of where these lines between the beliefs and identities of the people at the center of the business become somehow embedded within the business itself.
Excellent. Well, we've gone on a little bit longer than I planned there, so we're going to have to wrap up. But thank you so much, Chris and Theo. Thank you to anyone who has listened to the end to our fantastic chat. And we'll be back next month with a different lineup. Bye.
All right, thank you.
Bye.
The RSP is sponsored by the British Association for the Study of Religions, the North American Association for the Study of Religion, and the International Association for the History of Religions. The Religious Studies Project is produced by the Religious Studies Project Association, SCIO, a Scottish charitable incorporated organisation, charity number SC047750.
Brought to you by founders and editors-in-chief Chris Cotter and David Robertson, and managing editor Thomas J. Coleman III. Our features are edited by Marek Sullivan and Rebecca Barrett-Fox, and our Opportunities Digest by Ella Bock. Podcast transcription by Helen Bradstock, with audio editing by Gregory Schneider and Samuel Ward. Social media managed by Ray Radford, sales and marketing by Sammy Bishop, and video editing by Jonathan Tuckett.
Don't forget, you can support the project by using our amazon.com.co.uk and .ca links, or donating at patreon.com/projectrs, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, iTunes, and other portals.